finally, there is nothing to attain. You all understand those words, but the point is to attain it, to realize it in body and mind, and then to let even that go. There is nothing you need to attain. The endless chasing after this and that is what tires you out. In a sense, this is what prolongs, continues the suffering, the dis-ease. Thus, that very mind, the discursive mind, the seeking mind itself, must come to its own end. In a sense, it already is at its own end because it has no real foundation, it has no real basis. Stop feeding it and you will see. It has no hold on you. It has no reality unless you give it something. You must see how you are feeding the delusion. I mentioned that mondo exchange between Sekito, who had left the sixth patriarch after the sixth patriarch's death, and the master he went to visit, Seigen. Sekito went on to become one of the greatest, most famous of the early Chinese Zen masters, so famous that Basso or Matsu and Sekito, these two masters were lined up, and there's even an expression in ancient Chinese that says, if you haven't been to these two masters, you don't know a thing. And actually, each of these masters, Basso in Japanese pronunciation and Sekito, used to send monks to each other. There are many famous exchanges where Basso sends one of his monks to Sekito, or Sekito sends one of his monks to Basso. There was this kind of free exchange. Basso went on to become more or less the father of Rinzai Zen. Sekito went on to become, in a sense, the forefather of Soto Zen. Not that that matters. This was way before there was a Rinzai Zen or a Soto Zen. Maybe Sekito's most famous expression is, in a lecture, he spoke of mind is Buddha, Sokushin Sokubutsu. The mind itself is Buddha, awake, free of all dis-ease and suffering. This became a very, very famous expression, but at this point in early Zen, it was quite a radical expression. It was quite a leap, a jump from the categories of Indian Buddhism that were well known then. Mind itself, your mind as it is Buddha. Done. Well, one of the monks listening, understandably, had a doubt. Wait a minute. If this mind is Buddha, well, what the hell am I doing? Why did I become a monk? Why did I shave my head, come up to this mountain, study these sutras, meditation practice? Why am I devoting my life to becoming a Buddha if this mind is Buddha? Good question, isn't it? Master, if you really mean that, Sokushin, Sokubutsu, the mind, just as it is Buddha. What the hell are we doing? Huh? Good question. How do you respond? Huh? Sekito responded with a question. He didn't give an answer. Rather, he deepened the question. Once again, the monk asked in three parts, because this was the way Buddhism was understood back then, in terms of what's called geidatsu, or vimukti, vimoksha, awakening. This is a word that goes back before Buddhism. Liberation, literally something, liberation. If you don't get it in this life, the Pure Land. You've all heard of the Pure Land, this notion, not really heaven, but a kind of a place where it's ideal for practice, because we can't really practice here in this world. So there's a Pure Land Buddhism, very popular form of Buddhism, in a way much more popular than Zen. And then the final goal, whatever way you choose, is nirvana, the final extinguishing of the flame. So the monk, hearing this statement, mind itself is Buddha. Wait a minute, if mind itself is Buddha, what about liberation? I'm working towards getting liberated, awakened. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? So it's a good question. What about liberation? Freedom from all. Sekito responded, who binds you? Who binds you to bind, like to put in chains? A very precise response that cuts right through the question, doesn't it? Huh? What about liberation? Right here and now, who binds you? He might as well have said, I don't see any chains on you, brother. You got handcuffs on or something? What? The monk didn't get it, so then he asked the second question. Mind is Buddha. What about the Pure Land? And Sekito responded, who defiles you? Who makes you dirty? You need to take a bath or something? You look perfectly clean to me. Clean as a newborn baby. Still didn't get it, so then he asked the third question. What about nirvana? This is the ultimate goal of every Buddhist. What about nirvana? Sekito responded again with the question, who puts you in samsara? Samsara is the opposite of nirvana. Samsara is the endless dis-ease of suffering. The point of not only Buddhism, but of Indian religion in general, is to attain vimukti, moksha, liberation from all of that. In Buddhism, that was called nirvana, extinguishing the flame. So again, the monk asked, but what about nirvana? You've wiped away nirvana for me. I was working so hard. Who puts you in samsara? Right here and now. Who puts you in samsara? You might say, oh, well, Sekito avoided the question. He escaped. No, he answered the question so well that there was no place for the monk to stand in. In a wonderful, wonderful way. Anyway, if you know anything about Sekito, that is enough. Huh? What about liberation? Who binds you? Right here and right now, who binds you? What about the Pure Land? Who defiles you? What about nirvana? Who puts you in samsara? You must realize that fact for yourself. There is nothing to attain. And that must be decisively attained. The other master, Seigen, the master that Sekito went to visit, not much is known about him. He didn't leave a record. Often the Zen masters, or usually actually their disciples, leave a record of the sayings or the Dharma talks and so on. There isn't one for Seigen. Not much is known about him. But there's one expression that's so famous, any of you my age will know it. I'll be 68 next month. This is the one most famous expression of Seigen. He condensed his whole life of practice into these simple phrases. He said, before I studied Zen, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. After I had gone some way in the practice, mountains were not mountains. Rivers were not rivers. Now that I have come home to the place of true rest, mountains really are mountains. Rivers really are rivers. This kind of three-part statement, very famous. I trust you can see from your own experience. We all know the first statement. This is the statement of the rational ego self. I know who I'm me. The mountain's a mountain and I'm me. And don't you forget it. Because eventually I'm going to cease to be me. I'm going to cease to be at all. But anyway, put that aside. I'm me. I know who I am. Do you? Do you? If you did, what the hell do you do sitting here? So this is the first stage of the ordinary ego self, caught in itself. Thinking it knows itself. It knows mountains. Yeah, mountains are high. Rivers, yeah, they're wet. Yeah. But as he goes on to say, once I gave myself for some time to Zen practice, I got to the point where mountains were not mountains. Rivers were not rivers. Well, this isn't just kind of logical play. It's the point where, in Zen terminology, the great doubt arose. What is it really? For the first time, he came to see. Yes, he knew in some sense what was what, as we say, but he didn't know it all the way to the bottom. He knew, but he didn't know. He had great trust and faith, but he also had great doubt. And that's not to be denied. So in a sense, it's essential in practice to get to that point where you don't know that, as one of my friends who since has passed away put it, a Japanese scholar, practitioner, I didn't know that one and one makes two. This was a brilliant Confucian scholar, martial artist. But he said, at that point in my practice, I didn't know that one plus one makes two. That calculation was not there. That's not enough, of course. So he ends with that third phrase. When I finally came home, when I finally realized the living truth, mountains really are mountains. The true beauty and dignity of the mountain is now manifest in everything. Rivers really are rivers. He doesn't turn it into some transcendental play. Mountains are the formless, you know. Mountains, they're mountains. And that's just fine. That's more than enough. It's a very interesting expression. How many of you have heard of that expression before? If you've read Zen literature, you've read it, you've heard it. How many of you know Donovan, the singer-songwriter Donovan? Huh? Well, which song did he steal that from? He himself admitted in an interview that, as far as he knows, this is the first time that a Zen phrase was used in pop music, early 60s. First, there is a mountain, then there is no mountain in it. Juanita, I call your name. He missed the real depth of it, but it was kind of psychedelic version. But he admits he took that from reading that expression of singing. First, there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. He also quotes a couple of waka, Japanese. Well, Senyu, humorous poems as well. So, at least if you're around my age, you've heard it even though you didn't know. That was Sagan's Zen expression. That's how popular it was through, for him being from Great Britain, maybe Alan Watts or Christmas Humphreys or D.T. Suzuki, how they all mention this expression. But it's all there. It's all there. It's a little hard to see in Donovan's version, but it's all there when you yourself go through it. You know what it is to say, yeah, a mountain, it's a mountain, a river, enough. I know who I am. But until you get to the point where you don't know what that really is. The great, there's a good reason great doubt is called great, because it allows us to let go of all of our delusions, all of our fake knowledge, all that we think we know, so that we can finally come to it directly and immediately know the water in its wetness. Taste it for ourselves. Anyway, these are two expressions that perhaps sum up the Zen of Sekito. Huh? Who binds you? And now say again, mountains really are mountains. Rivers really are rivers. It's all right there. If you had the eye that is the whole body, the eye that is the whole universe. You see how simple it really is. It really is elegantly simple. Before there's even one, it's already fully manifest. It's beyond a shadow of a doubt. But to fully realize that, embody it. For some people it's a great struggle, for some people it comes more naturally. One is not better than the other, but we need to give all of ourselves. That's all. That's all. We don't need somebody else's question, even Sekito or Sagan, as interesting as they are. We don't need their question. We don't need their answer. We don't need their doubt. All we need is to go through what we already have and make it clear. You came here with everything you needed, as Sekito himself said. I mentioned in the Mondo yesterday, the exchange, huh? What did you bring with you? Sekito said, nothing that I didn't already have. Sagan continued, oh, then why come? Well, if I hadn't come, if I didn't come, I wouldn't have realized. What is that really? What is it? Where do we have to get to? Do you see? Where do we really have to get to? Hello? Hello? That's why we give ourselves in a retreat like this, huh? So that there can be no doubt whatsoever. And in a sense, that's the beginning of the real practice. Then, how do we bring it to life? How do we bring it to life? How do we serve others? You don't have to read the newspaper to know there's problems in the world today, huh? Oh, but Who defiles you? Yes, everything's pure and clean. Yeah, but take a good look. Take a good look. Don't hide from the dirt either. Unless you can put this to work in the world, it's useless. It's less than useless. It becomes an escape, doesn't it? A delusion that you hide behind. That's not what it's for. I remember well in my practice, for the longest time, just wanting to get away, and eventually I did, went to Japan, did a monastery, did that whole thing. It's really, really precious. But I also came to see how it can be a very dangerous escape. There's a time to go into a monastery, and there's a time when you need to leave the monastery, when you need to finish it. And part of finishing it is coming fully back to the world. To the world. Not running away. Not running away. Those walls of the monastery can become a great hiding place. So can this peace that you may find in your zazen, huh? Beware. Beware. My teacher passed away 10 years ago, and I did a kind of memorial retreat for him last month in Austria. And we took up many things, but perhaps today a very simple one, especially with the mountains and the rivers being what they are. A phrase that sums up my teacher, because it, actually his Zen name is taken from this poem. It's a part of a Chinese poem. Several of you know some Japanese, so basically two lines of a very famous Chinese Zen poem. Kaze shizumatte kara hana nao ochi. Who knows some Japanese? Who knows some Japanese? Don't be shy. Come on, some people even live. So what is kaze? Kaze. Wind, huh? Kamikaze. Kamikaze, you know, the planes. We call it the divine wind. Kaze. Wind, or breeze. The wind, kaze. Kaze. Shizumatte.
Shizumatte.
Yeah, to quiet or to stop. Shizumatte. The wind or the breeze stops blowing. Hana. What is hana? Hana.
Flower.
Hana. Yeah, also it also can mean nose. Yeah, but here it means flowers. Hana. Hana now. Now is an older term. Now. Ochiru. Ochi. Ochiru. The verb ochiru. Anybody know that? Ochiru. Ochiru. To fall. To fall. Ochiru. Hana now ochi. So after the wind stops blowing, a few petals fall. That's exactly what happens. If you ever look carefully, huh? The wind blows, of course, some leaves fall, some petals fall. But often after the wind blows, that pregnant stillness and silence, then a couple of petals fall. So that's what's being expressed here. Kaze shizumatte kara hana nao ochi. After the breeze stops blowing, a few petals fall. Of course, the wind is a common metaphor for practice and the result of practice. Then the next line. Tori naite yama sara ni yu nari. Yama.
Bark. Bark. Yama.
Yama.
Yama?
Yama.
Mountain.
The mountain is a mountain. Yama, mountain. So tori, tori naite. First, tori. What's tori?
Bird.
Yeah, bird. It means many things, but here it means a bird. Tori. Tori naite. Naku. Naku. You know naku, that bird? Naku. To cry, huh? Or to sing. Naku. Akachan ga naku, the baby cries. Here it's a bird, so it sings, or it chirps. 鳥鳴いて、the bird sings, 山、さらに、夕なり。The mountain becomes even deeper or quieter still. This is difficult because you, you not becomes even more you, you again. It's an aesthetic term. It looks like a mountain covered in clouds. The idea being that something is expressed, but it's only the tip. But by looking at that, you know the boundless. If you look at a real Chinese or Japanese or Korean Zen painting, a branch of a tree maybe, or some old guy walking, or a boat in the middle of a lake, something there, often very minimal. But it's that boundless, what's called yugen, that's really significant, that makes it great, fine art. So this is a difficult expression, but it means something like the boundless depth. So again, after the wind stops blowing, a few petals fall. A bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. The second part, mountain stillness, that's basically the name of my Zen master, Zen master. It comes from this, even deeper still, the mountain deeper still. Ko-yu-ken in Japanese. Ko-yu, yu is the yugen. And ko is another way of saying sarani, or even more, even deeper. Typical Chinese Zen. There's no Zen there at all. We're talking about birds and mountains and flowers. Where's the Zen? Huh? Give me some Zen. I want some Zen. There's no Zen there, man. It's just a bunch of nature. But of course, it's all there. Without exposing it. That's another element of the yugen. You don't have to expose it. It's already fully there. But again, especially the second line, the bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. For the ego self, that doesn't work. For the ego self, what happens? No sound. Mountain stillness. Okay. I got it. Beautiful. Got you. This is dead stillness. Dead silence. The mere lack of sound. If a motorcycle goes by, or somebody farts, or your husband snores, there it goes, going out the window. Well, that's not true stillness or silence, is it? The whole point of the poem, a bird sings, oh no, no more silence, no. Listen, listen without yourself. Let the bird sing itself. The mountain stillness deepens. The depth of that stillness and silence comes alive through the song of the bird. It doesn't end it. If it does, it's not true stillness, is it? To be blunt, true stillness, genuine silence, cannot be broken. If it can, it's not true stillness. It's not true silence. You see what this has to say about the states of mind that you're entering, huh? Absolute, clear, and still, not one cloud. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. Then you'll know. Don't hold on even to that. There are many Zen expressions that make this clear. Huh? Not a cloud for 3,000 miles still deserves a strike from the stick. Why? There's no clouds. Precisely. This is the way reality works. Reality is free of self. It is being without self. That's what reality is. Call it what you want, nature. Nature doesn't stay the same. It doesn't stop. It moves on without moving. It's continually changing, and yet it has nothing it needs to hold on to. Well, what about you? What do you need to hold on to? Have you seen that? Silence, stillness, some self-identity, Take a good look. Isn't that precisely what keeps you trapped? You don't need to stand on anything. Do you? Even Zen. Throw that out too. You don't need to stand, to rely, to make a foundation out of anything. Then it can truly and freely work, you see, without even being attached to itself. That's reality. That's what you are. Matter of fact, that's what everything is. When we stop seeing it through the lens of ourself, when we stop seeing it through our self-centered little, well, what's it going to do for me? We're not seeing it at all. We're just seeing our own reflection. No wonder we're not satisfied. Once, see what is in front of your face. That's all. We're not talking about up in the clouds. Once, see, really see what is in front of your face. And you will see there is nothing to attain. The whole world is at your feet. What do you want to attain? You want to be a little taller, maybe, or a little slimmer, or a little more enlightened? Oh, I forgot about that, sorry. I trust it's clear enough. Please feel free to stand up and stretch for a moment. Real point of the Dharma talk. Does anybody know the Allman Brothers Band?
Yeah.
It's an American band from Georgia. Two guitars that often play Bottleneck or something like that. Really, really popular in the 70s, 80s. Dwayne Allman was the guitarist. He died in a motorcycle accident. He's the guy who plays the really high notes in Layla. You know, Eric Clapton's Layla, the really high, the guitar song, that's Dwayne Allman. Also, the great song of Boz Scaggs, early Boz Scaggs, Loan Me a Dime, somebody loan me a dime, that's also Boz Scaggs. He was a studio guitarist for some time before he formed the Allman Brothers Band. You ever hear of Mountain Jam? They have a live version, it's like 12 or 15 minutes long on one of their albums, Mountain Jam. It's an instrumental based on Donovan's song, First There Is a Mountain. Listen to it. They're actually just playing the refrain for about 15 minutes and doing a guitar solo. That's how popular that song was. It transformed over to this blues band in Georgia, Mountain Jam. Okay, now you know. Now we can rest. Does anyone have a question or concern, musical or otherwise? For the benefit of all, please feel free to speak up. Yeah, Katrina.
So
So I learned that practicing doesn't end at the border of my cushion or the zendo. But when I try to transfer practicing into the outer world, I recognize quite often that there's some kind of necessity, or at least that's how it seems to me, to confront myself with dualism, with the yes and the no's, and aiming for something, and also evaluating things like when building up a company, leading a company, being parent, something like this. So I'm asking as a lay person, like, how can I solve this dilemma?
What you find is the deeper you sit on the cushion, the more it starts to naturally show itself in the world. And as it does that, it encourages you to practice. It's a kind of a synergy, But in the beginning, it can be very uneven, You sit here for a while and really develop some kind of a samadhi, concentrated oneness, and then you have to go back to the world. Oh, and all those unenlightened people, and it can really be a big contradiction, you call it a dilemma, If you're practicing correctly, that dilemma itself dissolves. You start to see that the real dojo, a dojo is a place of practice, the real dojo, it's not in here. This is the easy part. I hate to tell you, but this is the easy part. Sunday, when you go home, that's the real dojo. That's the real dojo. So, don't be afraid of it, but yes, be aware. That's right. You have to make decisions, don't you? Everything's not set out like it is here. In a way, you can just go without a thought. A meal is there. Well, maybe you have to choose what to take, but it's there. Take a break. Yeah. What time? 2:30, we sit. It's all done. Yeah. Has its value. That's what this retreat is for. But what it's really for is so that we can then return to the world and see it's not just another world. It's not just another world. But that's right. You have to face those things. You have to make decisions, make compromises, That's right. The deeper you sit here, the deeper it becomes out there, until eventually it makes no difference. It makes no difference. No matter how confusing or tense or intense it becomes, this just responds. There's nothing you need to hold on to. You see? If there's still something you want to hold on to, that tension will remain. You follow? What do you need to hold on to? When you're ready, Katerina, when you're ready, you just throw yourself out there without a mask. Well, maybe you need this one. But Without armor. You know what armor is? You know, without armor. But I remember myself for the longest time wanting to get away from that stuff. The monastery, wow. That was such a romantic notion. We can just sit there and practice all day, you know. Well, this is what people say who have never been to a real monastery. There's a lot of work, a lot of conflict, a lot of tension, at least 10 times as intense as in your life, I can assure you. It's a very intense life. I've seen people come to the monastery in Japan, in Kyoto, and all they do is complain about, oh, I miss my wife, I wish I was back home. And then when they go back home in the Netherlands, I visit them, and they say, oh man, you're so lucky to live in Japan, you can live in a monastery, whatever you want. It took years for this person to realize what he was doing. He was in the Netherlands dreaming about being in a monastery in Japan, but when he was there, he just dreamed about the Netherlands. So, face that, Katrina. Get confused. Lose your samadhi. And then you'll know. Okay? Let the world be the dojo, the place of practice that it is. That's where it has to come to life. You can see that, right? Yeah. Take your time. Be patient, but don't be lazy. Okay? It's a different kind of practice. And this is something we will take up on Sunday in the last Dharma talk. You know, how to go from here to back to the world. It's a good question. But let's return to it on Sunday. Okay? Right now, you don't have to worry about that, do you? It's interesting how your mind's already considering that. Do you see what you're doing? What about when I go back to the world? It's only Friday. You got two more days. That's eons. That's eternities if you use it well. Then you can answer your own question. So please don't indulge in such fabrications now. You'll go back soon enough, but right now you have the luxury, Katrina, of not having to even think about that, right? For the next 2 days, just throw yourself into this, and I assure you, you will know. You will know. Will you be able to go back and solve all the problems of the world? No, but you'll be able to do what needs to be done. Okay? We'll return to this theme on Sunday, if we must. Does anyone else have a question or concern or a comment for Katrina? I'm not the only one who can speak about these things. Yeah, Mika.
You say you must bring your mind to its own end. But what does it mean exactly? Is it only not to feed the mind anymore? Or it is more?
First of all, in the popular literature, it often sounds like just stop thinking, don't think, dualistic thought. This is nonsense. That's dualistic thought, right? Get rid of the dualistic thought and keep the non-dualistic thought. It's silly. What it really means is not just thought, but our feelings and our will itself. So thought, feeling, and will is all included. When Buddhism speaks of thought, it's a very general term, okay? So put an end to thought. Really, it means put an end to the mind. The discursive, you know what discursive means? The discursive mind. But that's not limited to the intellect, that's just the surface. Our emotions are also dualistic, aren't they? Right? I want to do what's good, but I often fail, don't I? And I feel love, but I also feel anger and hatred sometimes, don't I? Oh, you're split. The ego self is split all the way down the middle. It's not just the intellect. It's not a matter of just, you know, acting spontaneously. So much of Western Zen is really stop thinking and act spontaneously. This is nonsense. It doesn't solve anything. So again, it's not just thinking. That thinking, what that really means is our emotional world and our will itself is split. Right? The will itself is split. You can see that, right? In order to will something, you have to be pushing up against it. You have to, it's a desire to be something else, somewhere else, right? Well, that's already. Right? You'll never be able to will yourself into enlightenment. You follow? So again, the first point it's not just thinking, despite what most of the pop literature says. It's not just thinking. The ego self, that delusion, is split all the way through. So to let the mind come to its own end really means to let that whole discursive, what we think of as ourselves, I, me, mine, that's generated by this, and then we identify with it. You know what self-identity means, right? And then we try to untangle ourselves, and it's very, very difficult, isn't it? Because we're, in a sense, adding on to the confusion. So genuine practice must be letting that whole complex come to its own end. Thinking, feeling, and will itself. You see why a koan is what it is, huh? A koan does not allow an intellectual response. It doesn't work. But it doesn't allow an emotional response either. That's no better. Not even a willful trying to be stronger than the Roshi or something. You follow? That's all still stuck within the mind. Again, mind and thinking, these are very broad terms in Chinese. They include everything that we identify as ourselves. And yes, that is a delusion. So it must be put to rest. What remains? When you've put all of those delusions to rest, what I am, what I should be, what I want to be, when all of that is put to rest, what remains? What remains? Does that help? At least help to throw you into the real question that you are. You can't separate yourself from the question, you see? You understand it's not, where's the watch in the room? Oh, here it is, this is a watch. Zen practice is the one asking is inseparable, cannot be separated from what is being asked. You know what I mean? If you do that, it's already gone. The arrow has flown to Korea, as they say. It's this. This. It comes to include everything. That's the great doubt. But it must begin for each of us, right? Thinking, feeling, and will. The self in its entirety. That's what the koan freezes, in a sense. You follow? You can't escape into any of those when the koan really grips you, really grabs you. Do you want to say anything else, Mihai?
If you allow a personal question, are you able to practice this in the daily life to come to the end with all this stuff?
Good question, yeah. When you come to the end, how to say it, everything comes to its own end in a sense. Our experience, what we know of as the world, everything, it in a sense dissolves. That's why it seems scary, doesn't it? Oh my goodness, I don't want to lose Everything, my home, my family. But our thought, really our attachment, you see, the greed that underlies all of that, the false foundation, our greed is what holds it all up. And through genuine practice, when that collapses, the whole thing, it's clear in Buddhism, the whole thing collapses. What happens? Then reality flows back now from the source through all of the senses. You understand? Then the mountains really are mountains. You follow? They were mountains before, but we were apart from them. We were separate from them. Now they're really the marvelous mountains that they are. The problems of our daily life are the marvelous problems that they are. Yes, a chance to further refine our practice. In that sense, yes, it is endless. Am I always in a certain state? No, there's no state you need to be in. You follow? Once you've let that go, you're free to get angry. There's a time to get angry. To be joyful, to cry, yes, to really cry from out of that, yes, to be confused, yes, especially as you get older, yeah, simple things get kind of complicated as you get older, yeah, you know this, right, yeah, it doesn't all just disappear, but the foundation, you see, that grasping, that's the real suffering. And that is gone. So no matter how confused or troubled or painful physical sensations, pain, it's not the problem that it was. There's no place to hold it. Do you understand? Confirm it for yourself. I'm afraid we've gone over a minute or two. We will return again tomorrow, Saturday, and then Sunday, the last Dharma talk. So let us continue to give all of ourselves together to this marvelous practice. Thank you for your questions and comments. They're helpful for everyone, I'm sure.